There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show, and I'm really excited about the guests I have today. With me are Rachel Pritzker and Ben Hurd, two people who have been actively cruising around the world, in the case of Ben, helping people to understand the importance of nuclear energy in a world where we want to make abundant living accessible to as many people as possible. And we want to do it in a way that does not damage the atmosphere and cause us to wonder if society will be able to keep functioning using the built environment that we have today. You know, I have to say that this is not about, you know, climate change is not about saving the world. The Earth is going to be here regardless of how much mess the people on the planet make. The problem is we have an awful lot of us who will be underwater. That's not a good thing. So welcome, Rachel and Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rod. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very excited to have you guys. Tell me a little bit about what's been going on and some of the conversations you've been engaged in the last several weeks. I guess I'll start with Rachel. You and Ben both went to Miami to meet with the Nuclear Energy Assembly.
That's right. Yeah, I... So it's interesting how much more open the nuclear industry has become to outside voices now that there are outside voices who aren't only attacking them. So Ben and I, along with Matt Bennett of Third Way, were invited to speak on a panel about some of the other voices like us environmentalists now joining this conversation about the role of nuclear and its importance in really helping make sure that we figure out a way to power modern civilization with, as you mentioned earlier, not continuing this kind of climate change trend that we're at the moment barreling down. So the reception was incredibly warm. I think they were quite happy to hear that there are people out there who recognize the important work they're doing, and it's a real watershed moment for the nuclear industry in the U.S. anyway, because as a result of cheap gas and particular policies that favor intermittent renewables and do really nothing to preserve nuclear, we are right now at sort of a cliff of about to lose a bunch of the U.S.'s current fleet, which is close to 20% of our power. And, you know, that 20% is reliable, you know, on-demand energy, and it's not producing CO2. So that's something the environmental movement seems to have only just woken up to in the last really maybe month or two. So we came basically to say, look, you're not alone in this anymore. And folks in the environmental movement are now realizing that this is something that they need to pay attention to as well.
Yeah, it's wonderful for people who don't hear anything but negative stuff to have the positive voice coming from people like you and Ben and Matt. I mean, I've been saying it for years, but they say, well, Rod, you're just one of us. And
yeah.
But anyway, yeah. I mean, I wrote about the fact that I'm a little bit jealous of the way that you all have conversion stories, because I just don't have one.
Yeah.
I was always in Damascus already, I guess.
Yeah, you were there waiting for us, Rod. Exactly. You were at the end of the road saying, hello, welcome. Welcome to the Masters. It's interesting that, as Rachel said, it was very welcoming. And I think that conversion narrative, which is in no way a confection, you know, it's entirely genuine on our part. It brings not only a sense of, we've discovered that this is something that's quite great for the world, but actually that sense can often, and that understanding can often be a lot stronger than the people who have just sort of been at ease with it for an extremely long time. I think it actually becomes possible to lose sight of just how remarkable the technology is and just how remarkable its contribution potentially can be, because it starts to seem so de rigueur. Whereas when you've been coming from the outside trying to look at scalable energy solutions and coming up with Butkus, and then you sort of start to grasp what's on offer in nuclear, the wow moment is pretty big. And I think it's actually really quite valuable to be able to remind the people who do that work that this is actually something quite remarkable. And so I think that's a very welcome message. And Rachel, go on, please.
Well, I was just going to add that I think as a result of our conversion stories, we also have we have insights into what it takes for people like us to realize how important nuclear is. And for me, I can say that talking about the future and talking about the innovation happening in nuclear, some of the exciting new improvements and potential for scaling and addressing all the sort of previous concerns that many sort of come at nuclear with, including cost and, what to do with waste. For me, it helped open that door because it challenged all my assumptions about what I thought I knew about nuclear. And it helped me not only for initially get comfortable with some of the advanced technologies that are really right on the horizon, but once I got comfortable with those, I was able then to more comfortably look back at the current technology and go, oh, you know, this stuff actually is pretty remarkable too.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that position also enables us to do, which is very important, is to also be able to say in a very genuine and well-meaning way to express what we think they're really doing wrong and what we think they're really not getting right. And those sorts of messages are then, I think, received really quite well because they are coming from a place of, it would be better for us. It would be in alignment for what is of great value to us to see this industry do a lot better in a lot of areas, and we see some really, really big weaknesses. And I think that was what was particularly stimulating at Miami, was that we had all been watching, listening pretty carefully for a day and a half or so, and had a number of things that we really did want to shine a light on and say we need to make some big changes in the way we go about addressing some of these points. There was a lot of discussion about the relationship with what's termed waste. There was a lot of discussion about the approach and the attitude towards safety, and how there has been a great... I guess these issues have just been dramatically overcooked to the point where, the industry is stuck in a bit of a loop of trying to prove things so hard that it's all people can think about. And, that I thought made for an incredibly productive, 1 hour. I think it was only 1 hour, but boy, there was so much good discussion crammed into it. And, I've had some positive feedback a number of times in a number of events where I've been and spoken with others, but I can tell you that all evening for me, Matt and Rachel, the feedback was effusive and excited, and people had some real light in their eyes in reflecting on what that session had helped them think about and identified for the future. So that's tremendously exciting and tremendously positive. I don't want to overplay that, having been here now for a few weeks, because I am actually in the US at the moment, and I'm realizing that there is a crisis here right now, and peeling back the layers of this crisis, I realize that it's deep and it's broad, and It's a wonderful time for change when people start to realize there's a crisis. But I think right now it might be a moment of people perhaps realizing just how badly some of these issues have been let go and how much catching up there is to do to get some sense of control back over this issue. And, you know, so it's great to see people invigorated coming out of that. And I would just bounce that up by saying, boy, there's a lot of work to do.
I'm really happy that the that both of you were able to get to that meeting early enough so that you got to listen to others' talks and other discussions before you did your panel. Because a lot of times speakers come to a meeting and they, for whatever reason, can only fly in for their particular sessions and they don't have much time to stay afterwards. So it was great that you all were able to be there and to meet with people. Now, I don't know if you have had the opportunity to see that at noon on Friday, in your neck of the woods, the Precourt Energy Efficiency Center held the debate. Yeah. I really wish that my dream team would have been you and you two, instead of Stephen Chu and Burton Richter. Not that they're, I mean, those are, you know, fabulous, well-qualified physicists, but they're not exactly the match for Cavanna and Kamen that you two would have been.
Well,
interesting you say that, Rod.
Yeah. I have deep respect for Burt Richter and Stephen Chu, although I think there might be a self-selection process that involves you know, people who end up winning Nobel Prizes tend to be less good at debate. And I think part of it is that they are really good at being able to see the complexity, which and the, you know, minutia and detail of an issue, which often makes it much more difficult to simplify and clarify an argument. So, I mean, I'm not sure I would have been any better, but certainly Ben and probably Michael Schellenberger, or, you know, there's a whole host of people we have who I think are really good at communicating some clear distinctions about the challenges of decarbonizing without nuclear. So yes, I just hope we have more of those debates.
Well, I think one of the things that I really would have liked to have had you all be there for is the optimism and the understanding of what can be done, the advanced reactors that right. are not just on the drawing board, they're right. already through the basic science and demonstration phases. They do need to get into the commercial product development and get permission and get that out. But we're not trying to invent something. We're not trying to find some new physical or chemical law. We right. have a way. And, you know, it seemed to me in that debate that Kamen was able to provide a lot more visionary, hey, we're going to come up with these wonderful storage solutions and this, you know, smart grid or whatever, and it sounds great until you have somebody like Ben who's actually tried to put something together and say, wait a minute, this is really tiny. This is really small, and it's really hard to do it.
Mm, yeah, it's, you know, I think there's it's very, very important whenever these sorts of fora are on the table that we understand what the fight is, what the discussion is, and send in the correct team to fight it. And there are going to be some fights and discussions where I certainly wouldn't want to be in the room in the place of the likes of Stephen Chu or Burton Richter, both of whom I have the most enormous amount of respect for. Right now, I think that the fight and the discussion is a pretty high-level, values-based, visionary fight. And there's something about where Rachel mentioned, you know, skills in minutia, which excellent scientists need to have. Sustainability generalists, people who are trying to come up with a pathway for the world as a whole, well, they're big picture people. And Yes, certainly in my case, it's a matter of trying to look to those big picture outcomes and understand what type of system can get us there and what will and won't hinder us in the path of doing that. And I think that what's strong there is that you are, you probably come to a point of expressing as well or better the values that that audience is probably there to respond to. You know, if you are in an audience for that type of a discussion, then there's a strong chance that you've got very strong values about environmental issues, very strong values about biodiversity and wilderness and availability of fresh water and all of these issues. And you want to know how these things fit into that picture. I mean, that's really what I think you're trying to get a grasp of. And so to have messages like these are the visions and the values that we are looking for as well. And based on the work we've done, we simply have to embrace these technologies. And I think, as I said recently, I can't quite remember where actually, but the idea that, you know, for me, expecting to find nuclear a necessary evil and then discovering that actually it's a phenomenal good. At this point in the United States, I think we need lots and lots of discussions and debates of that kind. And to be able to hitch that wagon to stories of commercialization of technologies that are, as you say, they're not imaginary and there's no super duper science that needs to happen in the advanced nuclear space, in the fuel recycling space, that makes something that's extremely compelling. And then building a bridge back to the extraordinary contribution of the United States' existing nuclear fleet. And yeah, the numbers are wonderful. I mean, that's the irony that seems to have resulted from the loss of a couple of plants. The data is powerful coming out of that. The loss of clean energy and the step change in emissions and the step change in the fuel mix gives a really unshakable story of what's going to happen if this is allowed to proceed. And what it does is it wipes out any gains that anyone who's, no matter their enthusiasm for renewable technologies, whatever the effort they've put in over decades, will be rendered irrelevant if this closure of plants is allowed to continue. And you find yourself on an argument and a narrative where I think the vast majority of thinking people who are there to genuinely make a values-based decision are going to find it very difficult to walk away from the message you're telling them. I think those are the sorts of debates and discussions we need to be having a lot of in the US.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not criticizing at all. I thought that Stephen Chu and Burton Richter did a wonderful job. You know, they are not your typical scientists. They've both been involved in public discussions and public service. So they did a good job. I just thought that in some cases, your ability to be excited and talk about the things that you've been learning recently from people like Leslie Dewan or Jacob DeWitt or some of the other, and Caroline Cochran and all the other, you know, thinkers that are saying, this is really cool stuff. And we're some pretty smart people here who are, in the Silicon Valley milieu in some cases. Mm. Like I think that Jacob and Caroline are not too far out of town.
That's right.
So,
I also think that our excitement about the political potential for this new conversation is something that I know really captured people's imagination in Miami, and could be something that would be important to add to future debates. And that is, when you look at any political efforts around climate change right now, it is just so gridlocked. And yet our experience with a bill to clear a pathway for advanced technologies through the licensing process has had remarkable bipartisan support. You know, everyone from Inhofe to Sheldon Whitehouse, from the most extreme climate denier to the most extreme climate hawk in the Senate, co-sponsoring and making remarkably positive statements in committee hearings about this bill, because precisely because it's something new and It has appeal really on both sides of the aisle. So that is something that I think people are really hungry to hear, that there is movement and that the political process really isn't completely deadlocked and that it just needed something new.
Yeah, and something where we can come together on values and outcomes. We don't need to agree on every single point and make dramatic progress is incredibly, incredibly refreshing.
Yeah.
And, you know, those advanced nuclear technologies provide such an extraordinary gateway for so many people in so many ways. And it was a huge point that we tried to get across in Miami, which is that, you know, we are nowhere near at the point where the industry can behave as though these things are remotely either in competition or somehow unrelated. They are absolutely related. You know, the success of the advanced nuclear community really is going to rely a lot on the continuing success of the established nuclear sector. And I was speaking with Michael Schellenberger the other day, and he made a powerful point where he said, you know, name innovations, incredible innovations that have emerged from dying industries. And that's not the way it happens. You know, remarkable technology innovations emerge out of industries where the demand for what's going on is high. And so for the advanced nuclear community to think that the misfortune of the current nuclear fleet is none of their business is not correct. And similarly, for the established nuclear community, for the light water reactor community, to imagine that the success or otherwise of advanced nuclear has nothing to do with their fortunes, that is false. That is absolutely false. When people from all walks of life get some grip on what's available in the advanced nuclear space, it's amazing the the sort of free air that they will give to the existing nuclear sector to continue operating and doing what it's doing, because they have seen what is to come. And particularly in the waste space, to see that there is a dramatic solution to come, it really relaxes people in terms of their relationship with the sector as it already exists. And Rod, I know you've been covering the South Australian situation very carefully, and I raised this point in Miami as well. You know, I have an easier conversation at home if we have advanced nuclear on the table, when in the same conversation about establishing a used fuel storage facility. And if we have a used fuel storage facility, that can dramatically sway the fortunes of the light water reactor community for several decades into the future. This is a deeply intertwined family of technologies that still has more in common than separates them. And there needs to be, I think there needs to be substantial recognition of that and a great deal more effort in seeing those linkages and promoting them.
Okay, so you both are going to wear my new Fission Fan t-shirt, right? Whenever I come
yes,
up
please.
With it. I need to get Susie to design one, but that's what I really, you know, that's what I tell people. I'm a Fission Fan because we really are at a cusp of something. This is the new fire, as I told Google people about, I think 2008 was when I went and spoke in Mountain View and talked about fission is the new fire. It is a completely new way of generating what humans have always been looking for, which is reliable power that can move things, that can change the climate, that can, you know, their indoor climate, that can, you know, give them fresh water and clean air and get rid of the sewage that we all produce. And
the most remarkable part about it is that it takes up almost no space compared to every other form of energy. The amount of space it takes up is just tiny. I think that's a piece of the argument people often don't think about. And when we take seriously lifting everyone out of poverty, you know, the 2 billion people around the world that currently don't have access to enough energy, and, you know, the however many billion more people there will be by the end of the century out of poverty as well, that's it could potentially take a lot of land, depending on how we choose to generate that energy. So leaving more space for nature is one really tremendous benefit that I think people forget to mention when it comes to fission.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I get frustrated when I hear the energy storage discussions and when I hear the battery discussions, because I feel like people are overlooking a miraculous gift of nature, which is the amount of energy that is stored in uranium is extraordinary. We are never going to design a better battery than that. There's so much energy that's stored there that we can release in our own time, in our own way, which I'm pretty sure is what a battery is supposed to be. And that's what we call fuel. And we've been taking advantage of fuel for a really long time. It's just a dramatically better fuel. And speaking of the new fire, you know, Rachel, we've been talking so much about the heat issue and the industrial energy issue. And that's been a real sleeper that too many people, myself included, you know, hand up as seriously guilty, just wasn't looking at for a really, really long time, which is, you know, if you take the global energy pie, you can more or less divide it into thirds for electricity, transport, and industry. And the third that is industry is fundamentally heat. There's some other emissions there, but fundamentally what's happening is they're making a lot of heat. And they do that by burning things. And we are going to need to replace that heat in a way that doesn't release carbon emissions. How do you do that with a solar panel? How do you do that with a wind turbine? How do you do that with a solar thermal plant in a remotely efficient and effective way? And, you know, it can't come and go. Industries will not make the multi-million dollar investments in factories, in the sorts of equipment they need to do the tasks that they are doing when a power source is remotely unreliable, because it can destroy their equipment potentially if the power fails for too long. And there is this huge piece of the energy pie that is unaddressed. And it's one where the conversations about provision of electricity from renewable sources can go into quite a bit of detail. Now, I'm perfectly confident based on my own work that there really is no serious future for 100% renewable electricity. But it takes some conversing and some analysis to have that argument. Open up the discussion about heat, and it's open and shut in about two moves. You know, it's dramatic. And that is another really important area that we need to talk more about. I mean, have you found the same thing, Rachel?
Absolutely. I think it's an area people don't talk about exactly because their preferred solutions just to offer absolutely nothing. I mean, it makes sense. If all you spend your time focusing on are efficiency and renewables, then industrial heat is just not going to be on your radar.
Mm-hmm. And where is that? I just wanna... for the processing, for the manufacture of chemicals, for the manufacture of pharmaceuticals, everything you see around you has heat as an ingredient.
And Rod, I just want to come back to one thing you said earlier, which was that we have this new technology. And I think another thing that people often claim is that the reason renewables need subsidies and nuclear doesn't is that it's a mature technology. But when you actually compare the age of these technologies, you know, how long have we had windmills? You know, many hundreds of years. And actually, there was a New York Times headline in the 1880s that said solar panels are becoming super cheap. and you know, you look at the time that nuclear actually got to innovate, and really it was only a couple of decades before we locked into one particular technology and have done very little innovating since then. So, you know, if you imagine we still had the same cars or the same cell phones that we had in the 60s, they would be pretty different than they are now. And that's essentially what's happened in nuclear design. So there is just so much potential for improvement, for modularizing and for efficiency and, you know, for scalability to be added to this technology. So I really agree with you that it is this amazing new technology.
I like to tell people, remind people, that when my mother was born, and my mother's still alive and doing very well, we did not even know that fission existed. The entire physical notion that you could split a nucleus of an atom did not exist in 1933, which is when she was born. Now, in 34, Enrico Fermi actually caused fission, but he didn't recognize it. It wasn't until 1938, the early 39, that we recognized that you could, in fact, hit a nucleus of an atom with a neutron and it would split. You know, that was, and oh, by the way, when it split, it produced just enough new neutrons to continue a chain reaction. I mean, that's remarkable to me that, and but that's so new, the whole physical notion. Now, humans have known way before we had windmills that there was energy in the wind. I mean, we threw up something and moved something. We threw up a sail, right? We've had sails. I think you can find evidence that humans have been using sails for ship propulsion for several thousand years. You know, we've always known the sun had some warmth and light and all those neat things because we waited for the sun to rise and, you know, make us warm the next morning or give us something to see by. Those are nothing new. That's the engineers have understood that. And they've also understood for many years that we're not very satisfied with those sources of energy flows. It just, they're not controllable. And I also, Ben, I wanted to come back to your splitting the energy pie into thirds. Both of you live in areas where that's pretty much true. However, there are other areas of the world where you need to split it in four pieces. And the fourth piece is the fact that you need to either heat or cool your home.
Yeah, that's right.
You live in California, where the only place I've ever lived in my life where I didn't have an air conditioner was when I lived on the coast of California for 20 months. You didn't need it. There was, hey, just another shitty day in paradise is what we used to say to each other, you know?
Yeah. Well, you either put on a sweater or you take a sweater off, yeah.
Right. And sometimes it's both in the same day.
That's
why people had that silly California look of shorts and a sweatshirt wrapped, you know, tied around your neck.
Yep.
So that it would be available to you when you needed it. But
getting used to that climate right now, it takes preparation when you leave the house.
Yes.
Lots and lots of very small layers, because depending on whether a cloud passes in front of the sun or doesn't, really affects your comfort level. It's a weird place. It's a weird place. I like it. It's very odd. Very, very odd place.
Yes.
But you're right, Rod. Most of the world has to deal with major climate challenges in terms of, you know, comfort and productivity, whether it's the heat in places like, you know, I just was in India earlier this year, and one of our colleagues there, Joyashree Roy, she's actually an economist who's a member of the IPCC committee, does work on the temperatures at which human productivity just declines so precipitously that it's basically not workable. And for much of the year, that is almost all year, that is the case where she lives in Calcutta, and it's really only getting worse. Yeah. And that takes a tremendous amount of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it gets hot in my part of the world, you know, we have a climate that I think is a little bit akin to Arizona. When the heat comes, it comes very, very hot. And by day 9 or 10 of the heat wave, even with air conditioned cars and even with air conditioned homes, people begin to struggle. And you know, you get a sense that the city as a whole begins to struggle. You know, take that for, that might be 9 or 10 days. Take that for seasons at a time, for millions and millions of people with no air conditioning. And Rod, you know, in terms of what we've been up to lately, I've got to have a few reflections on the clean energy ministerial that I went to in San Francisco just a couple of days ago. And one of the things I'll say in favor of what I saw and heard that day, it was Eric Moniz making really clear recognition of exactly what Rachel has just said, which is that the ability to cool spaces for people is not a luxury issue. It's a health issue. It's a longevity issue. It's a safety issue, and it's a productivity issue. So if we've got incredibly poor countries and they would like to work and they would like to be able to do more, when it's that hot in northern India or southern India with the humidity as well, It's very, very difficult. And I think that there's, I don't want to generalize too much to my own, developed Western friends, but I think there's a perception that because you live there, you grew up with it, you're kind of used to it, it's not such a big deal. That isn't true. You know, when those heat waves come to India, people die. It's dangerous and horrible. And if you live there and you could afford it, you would get an air conditioner post haste. And a lot of the discussion in the ministerial typically was on energy efficiency. Now, energy efficiency for me is an everybody wins discussion. Everybody loves it. Everybody loves it. Everybody makes more money. And I think what you get with energy efficiency in something like space cooling is that a country like India, we can bring them to a lower ceiling in terms of what their eventual energy demand is going to be. But if you create a more efficient space cooling device, you're going to hit thresholds of cost where suddenly you might have 100 million new consumers who are now ready to purchase an air conditioner because you've made it cheap enough. So we might get a lower final ceiling on what the demand of India is thanks to air conditioning, but they will reach it faster because the growing efficiency of the devices will introduce them to hundreds of millions of new people quickly. And I think that is a good thing. That is an absolutely good thing. And in no way does it mitigate the need that we are going to need the most enormous amount of clean power to
Well,
deliver that.
and Ben, what you just described is what a man named Jevons wrote about in the 1800s, when he called it the coal problem. That the better you are at producing things and the way you drive down the cost, you do reach thresholds where suddenly a lot more people can afford to do something, to drive a car, to have an air conditioner. And when you're talking about areas of the world that are undeveloped, partly because the people are just plain oppressed by their weather, the weather is oppressive. We have a good example, at least I can testify, and I'm not that old, I can testify to a great example, and it's called the Southeast United States. There's a reason that Southerners talk slowly. When it's hot in Mississippi or Alabama or South Central Florida, it's hot. And it's not Arizona hot. It's muggy hot. It's the kind of hot where you don't want to move for fear of breaking a sweat. Where and that area of the world is now a pretty vibrant place to live. Because of air conditioning.
Yep,
And
absolutely.
I was born in South Florida before there was air conditioning.
And
Not
it's
too
different,
much
isn't it?
before, but I you know, my dad, we had a house that had no air conditioning, but he installed a room air conditioner in the living room at first, and we closed off all the bedrooms. And then I was lucky because I had allergies. And I could get a prescription from the doctor that said that I needed to have a room air conditioner of my own.
Oh, wow. That's extraordinary.
And so we did. We, you know, they said I needed filtered air so that I could sleep better at night. I mean that, but you know, I'm only 56 years old, and I can testify that you're not very productive if you can't sit at your computer without dripping on the
Oh,
Of course, it
absolutely. I
wasn't a
mean, that was
computer
how.
back then. It was a piece of paper, but
Well, and equally, you know, equally challenging is the opposite extreme. So you look at like Sweden, you know, people could not live in Sweden without a way to heat their homes. And if it's not cutting down forests, then it's using some sort of fossil. And then, you know, until they decided to electrify home heating and really, you know, invest a lot in both hydro and nuclear to decarbonize, you know, they were going to have higher emissions because there's no option. You really just can't live there without significant amount of energy to keep yourself safe from the cold.
That's
Well,
true. And
Rally and Jana from Finland, who've written that excellent book, Climate Gamble, that I'll happily plug because I think it's just so good. You know, their grandparents have barefoot in the snow, small house stories. You know, just a few generations ago, these people in Finland living without energy, and it was a poor existence. That what these economies and these countries that so many people now look towards so enviously, it's an energy change. They were dreadfully poor nations just a couple of generations ago.
Well, and strangely, I have my own, you know, similar story growing up heating with wood in Wisconsin, which is probably about as close as you can get in the U.S. to a story of, you know, Rowley's grandparents in Finland.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you get when you were living in a commune. I guess everybody pitched in and chopped the wood, though, right?
No, actually, it was mostly my dad. That was his form of exercise, and it was a lot of exercise.
Yeah. We call that camping in Australia, where we chop a couple of days. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's a holiday. You do it for a day or two, and then you go home.
But it's good. It's good to remind yourself.
Oh, very, very good. Right, I have to go back to the clean energy ministerial, because that was a really fascinating event for me. Having come out of Miami and seen one community not looking at some issues, but then when we challenged them, being prepared to look at them, I went straight to another community who were doing exactly the same thing in a different way. The extent to which this clean energy ministerial was a sort of glad-handing, back-slapping, self-congratulatory event for people and industries who are, frankly, they're on the up in policy terms, you know, and they're getting policy wins and they're getting support wins, and so they're growing. But there was, in the time I was there at that ministerial, not one single chart, not one single graph, not one single speaker to say, are we winning or are we losing? Are we cleaning the world's energy right now overall, or is it getting dirtier? Not one. And the answer is it's getting dirtier. The answer is we're losing. The answer is emissions are still climbing. But that wasn't the subject of the meeting. And I found it so dreadfully premature to be having these congratulatory sessions. No questions permitted, by the way. A renewable session with EDF on the panel. And EDF were there to talk about the EDF renewable sector. And the host of that panel actually joked that they were not allowed to talk about nuclear. And you could hear the chuckle, you know, roll across the room. And probably the only speaker that touched on a little bit was Michael Liebrich from Bloomberg. And he did a very, very good spider chart of how our energy system has changed over decades in terms of the energy mix. And the punchline being that it barely has changed.
Yeah.
And then showing where it needs to be with a new spider diagram with two very big peaks in nuclear and renewable. And you could practically hear the slushy sound of 600 eyeballs turning to not look at the bit that said nuclear and just looking at the bit that said renewable. You know, and you know what I was thinking? What I was there thinking? I was thinking Ben Hurd in 2006 would have loved this. 2006-07, when he'd done his master's and he was in the full-blown sustainability profession, this would have just seemed and felt great. And yet I looked at it today and I thought, this is so staid. It's so corporate. It's so profit driven. It's not exciting. And there were a bunch of great things being talked about, especially in the efficiency space, especially with the cooling, which I mentioned, all of which I agreed with and none of which is really getting to the heart of this problem. And it really made me think, you know, I've had a few people talk to me how there's a really alternative way of looking at this where, you know, we've got to actually go and do something really, really exciting. And I can tell you, it's not hard. The competition is poor. You know, if we can actually talk about what a world of plentiful energy looks like, start from there and talk about the technologies that flow from that in agriculture, in water, in transport, how we're going to reshape the world. And it would be a, you know, a punk rock equivalent, frankly, to a conference like that, which is now just, it's so co-opted. It's just become the new mainstream, and a new mainstream that's not actually looking at the problem. It's only looking at how well they are faring in the fight for providing solutions. I left very grumpy. If you check my Twitter feed, you'll see the proof.
Well, and Ben, you know, that elephant is already in the room. It just needs to be named. You know, it's like, so guys, what is the actual goal? Is the goal just to very, you know, slightly more quickly scale up some intermittent sources that are at maybe 3% globally right now of, you know, 1/3 of, or depending on how you chop this pie, 1/4 of, you know, the part of the areas we need to electrify? Or, you know, are we actually taking seriously the fact that we are going to give a high quality life to everyone on Earth, and we're going to do it like fully decarbonized? Like, what's the actual goal? And I often, especially when I hear people congratulating California as clean energy leaders, it's like, well, okay, but our emissions are coming down slower than other states. So what are we leading in? Are we leading in throwing up more solar panels, or are we leading in actually decarbonizing?
If you shut down one more nuclear plant, you're certainly not going to lead in decarbonizing.
That was the irony. On the very day I was in that ministerial, is it Exelon?
Yes.
Announced Quad and Clinton.
Yeah.
Will be closed. So I'm in a clean energy ministerial in California with a whole lot of backslapping and congratulations, listening to a stirring speech by the governor, Jerry Brown. I don't know whether he's aware that there's a huge clean energy source under threat in his own state right now. But if he is, I hope that his rhetoric applies to that and applies to saving that. And on the very same day, just across the country, two enormous sources of clean energy were announced that they would be put on the scrap heap for the sake of a cent per kilowatt hour.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
And we can go and look with, you know, what they'll be replaced with, because we have a lot of precedent all across the country. Every time this happens, we can look at Vermont Yankee, we can look at San Onofre, and now we'll have, you know, more test cases in Illinois. They will be replaced almost completely with fossils, so emissions will go up.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that's going to happen. So, as I have probably shared this with both of you before, but I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out the logic of what you all have been seeing in terms of the congratulatory and the celebration of growing renewables and whatnot. The most logical thing I can think of, and there are people that fight me every time I say it, but the most logical thing I can think of is that renewables are a purposeful distraction to try to discourage people who are interested in clean energy from going to the big elephant in the room, nuclear, and instead spending time thinking about things that aren't going to replace fossil fuels. Yes, the planet, there will be less energy available to people, but the people that are doing well are going to keep doing well. If the price of fossil fuels is a little higher, it doesn't matter to them. That's their income anyway. If you go back and look at the history, the solar industry, the solar panel makers in the U.S., the first ones were two oil companies. And they weren't doing it because they thought solar was going to replace oil. They thought that solar wasn't going to replace oil, but this nuclear stuff just might.
Yeah, well, I have a hard time going there with you, Rod, because I having been in that environmental community, I really do believe that most people there genuinely believe the rhetoric, and they just really haven't questioned their assumptions. So, yeah, I have a hard time going into the sort of nefarious underpinnings of it, but
Yeah, but a guy like Dan Kamen it cannot say that he can't do the math. A guy like Amory Lovins can't say he can't do the math.
No, for them, I think it's like it's become more like religious dogma, and it's so much a part of who they are and their identity and their tribe and
Their job.
Yes,
Amory Lovins gets paid about $350,000 a year, and he's had some years where he's gotten paid over $1 million a year to run a very small nonprofit organization of about 14
million
bucks.
And it's also ego. I mean, they've become famous as a result of their previous positions, and changing them, I think, endangers all sorts of things, both their job, you know, their community, but also their good standing in that community.
Well, here's something else that again, I'm going to step on some toes because that's what I do. But the Clean Energy Ministerial in San Francisco, right?
Yep.
Okay. It was hosted by the U.S. Department of Energy, led by a guy who was supposedly a nuclear advocate.
Right.
Okay. If he wanted to make sure that nuclear was part of the conversation, it was well within his power to do so. Okay. Now, who did he choose to be the master of ceremonies for his clean energy ministerial? Kevin Knobloch, who, before he became the chief of staff of the U.S. Department of Energy, was the executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yeah, although I've talked to him, and he's actually much more open-minded than that the job resume would indicate.
But so I get what you're saying, right? And we've had this discussion here as well. I mean, that agenda was troubling.
It was political.
And that can't be allowed to happen. And again, when I talk about the crisis that I think is unfolding here in the U.S. and just a lot of people waking up and realizing that they're in one, you realize that a meeting like that is happening and that agenda is being set progressively over, 12 months, 18 months? You know, there are long lead times on these things, and it is very political. And I say this with an honest level of respect as someone who's only just starting to come to grips with the United States. This is a very big country. And the sums of money at stake are huge. And the nature of the discussion and the nature of the fight in a country this big is different compared to a country like Australia. And, you know, when we talk about the rhetoric...
Who's rattling papers?
When we talk about the rhetoric and people believing the rhetoric is good. I mean, these people do a good job when they are up there of talking about their growth, talking about what they're going to do next, announcing a new target. If it's what makes you feel compelled, they do a pretty good job. I mean, I see behind the curtain because I came up through sustainability as a profession and I've spent time thinking that these are the solutions. So I can see what's not being looked at, but I can tell you they do a good job. And more work needs to be put in to doing a better job. Agendas like that, you know, there needs to be a lot of attention paid to what is in the pipeline in terms of events, how that agenda is being set, and putting work in. Absolutely, nuclear to not be represented in that whole agenda, it's crazy. And Matt Bennett quipped that it's like having a grain conference, a global grain conference, and leaving out rice.
You know, and wheat.
Yeah, exactly. It's the perfect comparison. Now, myself and Canon, Brian from Terrestrial, we went to the expo together, and we had money on zero nuclear representation in there. And we were actually pretty pleased because we went in there and we found NuScale there. We found Maltex from the UK there. And we found KEPCO, who among their other endeavors put plenty of focus on what they were doing in nuclear. So that's three, and it's three more than zero. And that's actually better than I was expecting, and clearly not good enough because the room was dominated by solutions which, for me as a sustainability professional, they are optimization steps. There was a lot in there about small-scale transportation. There was a lot in there about electric vehicles. There was a lot in there about software and ways to optimize grids. These, for me, are exciting, they're interesting, and they're tweaks, which will be fantastic when the underpinning energy is clean.
Yeah.
So it's you know, we've got to decide either, you know, I don't want to be leaving this clean energy ministerial on a bad note. I guess what I want to say is there's an opportunity there to either, or perhaps we should be doing both, putting in the focus and the long lead times to make sure the representation improves and to improve the quality and the rigor of the discussion. That's point one. And there's another huge opportunity, which is to just throw up a completely different narrative and a completely different vision. Frankly, you know, it would be punk rock compared to, you know, what I sat through in San Francisco. People who are actually changing the world, people who actually get how big the world is. And, you know, I see it in South Australia as well as here in the US. You know, the scale, the size of the world, the size of what we're looking at and what we're doing, it takes a bit of courage, you know. It takes some guts to really be prepared to wrap two arms around the world and really think big, think in terms of those big scales. And we can do both. We can do both much better. And, you know, I think San Francisco was, I hope that clean energy ministerial gets noted as the missed opportunity, the one that enough attention was not being paid to, and something that now needs to start getting a lot more attention paid to it. But yeah, there's a lot of work to do here. There's a lot of work to do here in the US in picking up everything that's been let go for a few years and acting fast, because there's a bit of a crisis going on.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and I love the notion of punk rock, although I wasn't a punk rocker myself, but the whole vibe is people who really didn't worry too much about offending somebody. Right? That's really what you saw in this rather corporate backslapping clean energy ministerial, were people who may be starting to question inside, but they don't want to offend anybody. They don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs right now. But you know, I'm sorry. I'm going to keep pointing out that the supposedly nuclear friendly U.S. Department of Energy, when they said they were going to double clean energy research, they have cut about 30% overall from the nuclear advanced reactor budget and added more than doubled the expenditures they have on nuclear waste without taking it out of the nuclear waste fund. Seriously, it's mind-boggling.
The issue is people have yet to put nuclear in the clean energy bucket, like, category in their mind.
Right, and so, but Ernie Moniz should be doing that.
Yeah, but he, you know, he has to do what works politically, and what works politically is what people think and, you know, the categories that people want to support don't yet include nuclear. So I agree with Ben. We have to do a lot more. But I also think, you know, when you said there are probably a lot of people in that ministerial meeting who are starting to question on the inside, people have to be brave. You know, it is it's too urgent. We don't have enough time for people to comfortably sit back and not say something.
That's absolutely right. And that was so much of what, you know, I was hoping to get across in Miami. You know, that was quite a big auditorium, and there were, I think at most, there were like 800 people in the room. That's a good slab of the industry. And I don't want to take for granted that every member of the United States nuclear industry is really interested in clean energy, is really, really interested in development, poverty, and all of these things that are happening. Maybe these people just do a job because they enjoy it. That's absolutely wonderful. However, if any of them are, if those are values that are strong and are an underpinning of why they are doing that in the nuclear industry, this would be a really, really good time to start making themselves visible and being as loud about that as they possibly can.
And outside their industry also.
Outside, exactly, speaking out. speaking out of the industry
yeah.
and getting that message across. You know, we get, I'm not in it, but I see that the narrative technique of anti-nuclear, or one of the many, is dehumanization, is to make it a machine, is to make it industry, is to make it something cold, scary, ugly, that everyone hates. When in fact, what it's made up of is a lot of really, really wonderful people. And if those people are sharing those sorts of values, now is an excellent time for them to put their face and their name to it and start speaking outward to be seen and to be noticed.
And one great example of that is something recently formed called Mothers for Nuclear. And it's two young women, well, young mothers, obviously, who are also engineers who work at Diablo Canyon, our last nuclear power plant here in California, who wanted to show the human face of the people in this industry who are doing what they're doing because they believe in it and because they believe they're providing an important, really invaluable service. So I totally agree with you, Ben.
You bring up Mothers for Nuclear, which is one of my favorite new organizations. There's also a march being planned, right, for the 24th through the 28th. Is that the right dates?
I know it starts the 24th. I can't remember the day they end up in Sacramento, but it's on the website. And this is June we're talking about.
Right.
And people are coming from all over.
It's called the March for Environmental Hope. Is that correct?
You got it.
This is something that if you have any ability to get to California for this march, it would be something that I think is going to be historic.
Let me endorse that. We don't have a nuclear power sector yet in Australia. I would like it. If you work in the nuclear power sector here in the United States, I think it's a good time to appreciate that you are under attack every single day right now. People with very, very large budgets, professional lobbyists, people accepting money from your competitors go out of their way to attack you. And there seems to have been a decadal strategy of just perform well, just
keep
do the job
down.
Well,
yeah.
Keep your head down.
Yeah.
Let's make those plants run sweet,
yeah,
and do it well, and that will defend us. And I'm sorry, but it hasn't worked. That the time for that is now closed. And so, if you actually believe in the industry, and if you think you are doing this for the right reason, it's time to appreciate that you're under this attack, and it's time to fight back. And this is a really, really good opportunity to come and do some fighting back.
And you can find info about it. The Mothers for Nuclear website has a link to more info about the march. And their website is mothersfornuclear.org. And also environmentalprogress.org has a link to info about the march. And I just checked the dates. And you're right, Rod. It is June 24th to the 28th. So hope to see everyone there.
Right. There's Absolutely. Something magic cool. about the 28th. I believe that's a day when there's a meeting in Sacramento about an important permit that needs to be renewed. Diablo Canyon has permits to use once through cooling, and the superstructure, the structures, had to be built on land that's owned by the state because it's in the water line, and they took so long to build the plants that those water permits or the permit to use that land are expiring before the license for the plant expires. And if they're not renewed, the plant will be shut down because there's no way to effectively cool the plants without having those water permits available.
I mean, that is a great example of what we've just been talking about. You know, it is all it is legal strategy and gamesmanship and finding every angle to find that shutdown opportunity. That's the nature of the attack that is currently being launched on the United States nuclear industry in a concentrated, dedicated, committed fashion. I mean, it's a simple political decision to make a renewal. Is that fundamentally what you said?
Well, and imagine if they had to do an environmental impact assessment of shutting down the plant.
Right.
You know, imagine if they actually had to study what would happen if it's all replaced with gas, which it mostly will be. You know, that is going to have all sorts of negative consequences, you know, including, you know, not just including the emissions in terms of our, you know, climate impacts, but just literally the air we're breathing and the particulate. So I mean, it's really a shame that people don't have to actually take into account the impact of this decision for both sides.
Hey, Ben,
Yes, Rod.
I want you to think carefully about what you just said in terms of the strategies and the careful effort aimed at getting the nuclear plant shut down. And then ask yourself, is that the kind of action done by a profit-making corporation type person or an idealistic environmentalist?
Oh, Rod, we have the evidence is eking through now. I mean, I think Mike Schellenberger has done quite a good job of this, and he's kind of got him. You have some very, very large supposedly environmental organizations, and their money, they're accepting money from the people whose interests lie in seeing these plants close down. And so you just have huge alignment of political and financial interests in having this plant closed down. And I mean, I know that a few years ago, I think it was you, Rod, actually clipped a couple of minutes of me in a debate explaining how these renewable solutions are actually renewable and gas solutions. And all we hear about is gas. And I actually sort of reshared that the other day to say, yeah, here we go again. The interests are really, really clear. But this is what I think is tricky, and it's worth understanding. The US is so big that you can spin a really believable narrative that you're making a really positive change by doing your solar or by doing your wind or by doing your efficiency, because you can come up with a remarkably compelling amount of electricity, of panels, of emissions that sounds really, really great. Because this country is huge. And because the quantities that we're talking about is huge, and people and the players will very readily dissociate their piece from the whole, and they will sell their piece. And something that people like me, and I think Mike and Environmental Progress and Rachel do a lot better, and we have to do more and more of, is reminding people of the whole. What is actually going on in your energy system, and what are the drivers? And indeed, where is the money coming from? And we're seeing it. That coalition in Illinois, they are people who have accepted money, it seems, from interests who have a clear fiduciary interest in seeing nuclear exit the generating space. And I'm very, very happy to see a light shone on that.
Well, good. Well, it's now at about an hour and 15 minutes since
Oh
we've
my
been
God,
chatting.
really?
Well,
Oh, man.
maybe it's about an hour since we actually started recording, because
So much fun.
took us a while. But I want to keep these kinds of discussions going, and I'm so happy that you all could join me tonight and share some of your experiences. I guess this is more like a 5-minute warning.
Well,
what have we not talked about that we really should be talking about?
I also, before we move on, I just want to thank you, Rod, for hosting this forum. I think you keep a conversation going that's really, really important. So thank you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. I don't know. What would I probably like to wrap up in closing? Your country is big. It's a complex beast, and there are a lot of different players. I'm seeing a lot of really, really exciting opportunities here in the US to do things better and smarter than they've been done in the past. I'm seeing a wake up that's happening in the whole sector. Compared to, say, 2 years ago, it feels like a very, very different space in terms of people realizing politically, for example, the advanced nuclear story has progressed really, really nicely with the US realizing that they were sitting on all of this intellectual capital that was going unrecognized, and now they're starting to work on that. That's wonderful. There seems to be a lot more clean energy messaging that's starting to come together from the US nuclear industry. I think that's great. I think there's a lot more to be done there. I think the individuals, and I've met a lot of them now, and they're great people that work in the US nuclear industry. I hope they start to take it personally. You know, one of the books that used to sit on my shelf was, who started the body shop? Was that?
Do you remember? I can't remember her name, but I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Sure. Well, she had a book called Take It Personally.
Mm.
And I think it would be great if people, if, I mean, Mothers for Nuclear is just the perfect example of taking it personally. Yeah. And I think now is a very, very good time for people to work in the US nuclear industry to take it personally and to appreciate that people don't want them in this space when they actually provide something remarkably positive. And it's time to fight. And it's time to do some more fighting. It's an exciting time in front of us.
Absolutely. And I also think that just in the last, you know, month or two even, people like Michael Schellenberger and Mothers for Nuclear and others have really shined a light on this topic of the impending closing of, you know, the current U.S. fleet, which was basically something no one had talked about. I mean, it's really almost unbelievable. It basically wasn't even included in the Clean Power Plan. So it's something that really is only just hitting people's consciousness. And,
you know, let's give a shout out there, Rachel, to Meredith.
Absolutely.
Anglin.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Meredith Joan Anglin with Yes Vermont Yankee. I mean, she was watching this, and yeah. Boy, did she fight. And she lost. And we see that now. But, you know,
but from that
so
story,
in a sense, let's do
now,
it for Meredith. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a handful of people who were ahead of the curve, and we have more coming to, you know, the realization of the importance of this. But we have a lot to do because it is an urgent, immediate issue.
Yeah, and I would reinforce that it is the business of anyone in the advanced nuclear space as well to sit back and imagine that it somehow works to your advantage, or it's ambivalent as to whether or not existing nuclear plants operate in the United States. I would say that no, it is not. Yeah. It is very, very important to the future prospects of the advanced nuclear sector to see a thriving nuclear sector. Even on the simple basis, like with the Illinois example, I mean, all that is really being sought there is a technologically neutral valuation of clean energy.
Yeah. It's just now, amazing we can't do that.
Right. If you're in the advanced nuclear space, you better be standing up and fighting for a technologically neutral valuation of clean energy.
That's right.
And, you know, I don't want to sort of corrupt what's a very moving idea about, you know, first they came for them and I did nothing, and eventually they came for me and there was no one left to help. But it's important to keep that sort of message in mind, that just because it's not your business today doesn't mean it won't be your business tomorrow. And if the value behind it is something that you would agree with, which is that we should have a technologically neutral valuation of clean energy, just because I don't have a product in the game right now, I'm working on it, but I don't have it, doesn't mean you should ignore that. That's got to be everyone's business.
Yep.
Again, thank you both. I really appreciate it. And, oh, by the way, I will plug the fact that Meredith Joan Anglin has a book that should be out in the not too distant future. I'm thinking it's probably within a couple of months that it will be released. That will be explaining to people what you can do to build an organization. She's got some great lessons learned. Sometimes, you know, you can learn an awful lot even in a effort that ultimately didn't succeed. But
yeah. Oh, yeah.
She's ready to share those with other people, and help people build organizations that can really stand up and fight for these valuable assets in this incredibly capable technology. That as Ben, I love what you talked about. That, you know, I've used the phrase to people who talk about energy storage to say, you know, God, nature, whoever you want to credit for it, does a pretty darn good job of packing yeah. energy into a very small space. Mm-hmm. I keep one of the ANS cards on my desk, which has the tiny little fuel pellet that's the size of the tip of my pinky, and says this pellet contains as much energy as a ton of coal, or 17,000 cubic feet of natural gas, or 147 gallons of crude oil. Those are remarkable numbers.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, we can do about 20 times better than that if we work on fast breeder reactors. But anyway, thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Thank you, Rob.
Now that it's almost in the evening in California, and it's now nighttime here in Virginia. But I will unfortunately be a little bit quiet for the next month because I'm got the wonderful opportunity of teaching a group of gifted high school students about nuclear science.
So oh, cool.
That's one of my favorite summer jobs. I'll be working for the Duke TIP program, and I think they'll give me between 16 and 20 young minds to mold for 3 weeks.
Well, those are very lucky young students, right?
So. Yeah.
That's a privilege. I would have been grateful to have a teacher like you. So good on you. That's great news.
All right.
And thank you so much for having us, Rob.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Such a better way today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.